You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Pandora Heftanarson, the narrator of Lionel Shriver's latest novel, Big Brother, doesn't recognize her brother Edison when he arrives at an Iowa airport for a long overdue visit and has to be removed from the plane in a wheelchair. Edison has gained 200 pounds in 3 years and barely resembles the svelte jazz pianist who made a career in New York City. As Edison's visit stretches from weeks to months, straining Pandora's family to the breaking point, she wrestles with the boundaries and obligations of family as she tries to figure out how to keep her brother alive. This is Lionel Shriver's 11th novel. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Nice to be here again.
You haven't tried to hide that this novel grew out of a personal situation. Didn't your older brother Greg die in 2009 from complications related to morbid obesity?
Yes, he did, and that was certainly the immediate inspiration for writing this particular novel at this time.
And I'll ask you about that at this time in just a moment. In an essay that was published in The Guardian on the eve of his last hospitalization, you wrote that your brother was eating himself to death. Had he always had problems with his weight?
No, and that was one of the interesting things about his story. And I think weight gain also often has to do with a reaction to either an emotional issue or sometimes another complicating medical one. And in his case, he had a couple of severe accidents which limited his mobility. And, of course, that meant he burned a lot less energy, and the disability curtailed his professional opportunities, and that meant there was all the more time to eat. And he had fewer places in his life that he could get satisfaction. So
it's like self-medication.
Yes, it is a form of self-medication.
He died of congestive heart failure at the age of 55, only a couple of weeks after your column was published. Did the research that you did for this book help you better understand what had driven him to gain all that weight?
Well, not exactly, in that one of the things I came to conclude is that everyone has a different reason for gaining weight. It's a little bit like what I concluded about school shootings back when I was writing We Need to Talk About Kevin, that there is you can make some broad generalizations, but beyond that, every individual is different, every story is different.
When someone dies that young, their loved ones always wonder if they could have done more.
Yes, and that's I think that's what the book rounds on, that experience of death is almost always intertwined with remorse. And I've never had anyone die on me when our relationship was in a perfect state of grace.
And then you think about all the things that you wish you had said, resolved.
Or hadn't said.
Now, let's get back to that thing about right now. How does that apply?
Well, I'm often interested in writing books where I have some personal motivation, but that whatever small story in my life it also intersects with a larger social issue. And in this case, I thought the time was right, not just because I was bereaved because of obesity, but also because obesity had become such a pressing issue in the Western world.
Well, you've said that your own unorthodox eating and exercise habits have gotten some unwelcome attention from the media since this book was published. There was even a thing in last Sunday's New York Times magazine. Is that the price you pay for being a successful writer today?
I think that some of the press have gotten, especially in Britain, where this book came out first, has become an illustration of the problem, if you will.
But the British can get rather snarky on the book pages.
The British press in general tends to be nosy, personal, and below the belt. So I shouldn't have been surprised. They're always butting their nose into your business. But beyond that, I just ran up against the complete obsession with weight. And, you know, anything to do with fitness or diet, everyone gets hysterical. And if you weigh a couple of pounds less than they do, then they consider that as some kind of criticism of them. How did we get this way? I mean, it's been quite a revelation. There are apparently whole websites that just follow what particular celebrities weigh.
Well, you've named your narrator here Pandora, so to some degree, haven't you just
opened
up
the box.
That box? Now, you must have done that on purpose. Are you telling us something about Pandora's situation by giving her that name?
Yes, there's a hint that when she invites her brother to stay, she has started something she is going to have to finish. And it's an atmospheric thing.
She's a 40-something stepmother of two teenagers married to Fletcher, a high-end furniture maker who works from home. We get the feeling that Fletcher has been dreading Edison's visit. Why? Don't they get along?
No, they hate each other. And, you know, tension between a spouse and a sibling-in-law is very common. I think there's a natural competition for intimacy there.
Also, yeah, Edison and Pandora spent a lot of time talking about family things, like their father, who was the star of a TV series when they were children. Interestingly, the series was about a divorced couple and their kids.
Yes, called Joint Custody. I had a great time making up my own TV series from the 1970s. But this series, of course, is something that the grown brother and sister have in common that shuts the husband out.
But Fletcher is a difficult character to like, even if that weren't happening. He's fanatically focused on his own health and weight and looks down on people who aren't as fit as he is. What does Pandora see in him?
Well, he has his moments of warmth. He's an attractive man. He makes beautiful furniture. He's a very good father. But it's true that he has become what she calls a nutritional Nazi. And it's become also a problem for their marriage because she used to be a caterer. And when they fell in love, she was cooking all these foods all the time, bringing home the leftovers. And it's one of the things he loved about her. And it was one of the ways that she expressed her love for him. And then suddenly he won't touch her lasagna.
You wrote an essay in defense of unlikable fictional characters that was published in the Financial Times a couple of years ago. And in it, you discussed Eva Kachaturian, the fictional mother who narrated We Need to Talk About Kevin. Is Fletcher another example of that kind of character?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm interested.
I mean, you wrote him with that in mind.
Yes. First off, I am interested in what's wrong with people. I think we all are. Nobody wants to read about a paragon. They're just too boring. Besides which, they're fictional.
And it must be fun to write somebody like that and still make that person not totally despicable.
Yes. I mean, you need to make sure that you unless you want a total villain, you need to make sure that there are nice things about
them. Do you
ever
write total villains?
Not very often. I think they're a lot of fun when you commit to a villain. And if I had an ambition, I think literarily it would be a lot of fun to craft somebody who's completely, utterly hateable.
My guess is Lionel Shriver, whose latest novel is called Big Brother, the big cutting two ways, because he is the older brother and he is quite huge. And he isn't especially likable either. Edison is loud, thoughtless, messy, obnoxious, in addition to being morbidly obese. Is he trying to give people a reason to dislike him that has nothing to do with his weight?
Oh, I think he's someone who isn't conscious of being obnoxious. I mean, he talks too much, for one thing, and he's constantly spouting off about jazz. He's a jazz pianist. And I think that people who do that it's not that they're know-it-alls and they want attention. People like that use verbiage to keep other people at bay. It is a defense mechanism. And it's actually a little heartbreaking because on the one hand, they're talking all the time, and on the other, they're completely failing to communicate.
Well, you've pointed out that in our society, obesity has shifted from being a health issue to being something of a moral issue. Fat is bad, thin is good. And people who are very overweight have to contend with that and contend with the judgment of others.
Yes, I think that's one of the extra burdens of being heavy these days is that we now consider it a sin. And I resist this, and that's one of the issues that I try to explore in the book.
Despite the fact that you remain very thin yourself and have very limited eating habits.
Well, fair enough, but that's not to say, this is good as in virtuous, and it's not an imposition on other people. I mean, I don't like this new moralism about fat. If you're so heavy that it's going to be endangering your health, fair enough, let's talk about it in those terms. But I think we are often confusing the aesthetic with the medical.
Pandora is her family's primary breadwinner, and she runs a highly profitable company she founded that some reviewers have said, hey, that's a good idea. Why hasn't somebody else thought of that? It's called Baby Monotonous, and it makes personalized dolls that, when you pull the string, repeat a series of pre-recorded annoying phrases that are used most often by the person the doll represents. Who would buy a doll like that?
I think a lot of people.
Annoyed parents?
It's funny, before I committed to this company in the book, I went online just to make sure that there wasn't a company that made custom-made pull string dolls. And I didn't find any company that made them, but I found several people who were looking for them. So I found the market.
So has somebody since then asked, well, first of all, do you own the copyright now?
I have not patented the idea. And anyone can have it. I have my hands full with writing books.
In this case, Pandora makes more money than her husband. That often can cause problems in a marriage as well.
That's one of the things that's clearly driving Fletcher's fitness fanaticism. And because he needs to exercise control over some part of his life. He has to be superior to her in one realm, and that helps compensate for the fact that she ends up making a lot more money than he does.
Do all of these considerations occur to you while you're working on the book?
How much
did you know before you started?
I work out those details in advance, yes. So that, it gets more refined as I write the book, but I tend to design both characters and plot it ahead of time.
For example, Pandora has always worshipped her brother Edison, who had left the family home in Los Angeles when he was 17 years old to break into the New York jazz scene. And looking back, she wonders if he was damaged by having so much success early in life.
I do find that people who get early success often suffer for that. It's just structurally not a good plot for your life to do really well at the beginning, unless you keep doing better and better and better. And that's hard to arrange. It's more commonplace that people do really well, and then their expectations for the rest of their lives become astronomically high and are often not met. And that kind of long denouement for decades and decades thereafter, where you're always being compared to your earlier young self, I think that would be awful.
Well, this is a problem that writers have, isn't
yes.
it? And I mean, people are always going to remind you that you had a phenomenal success with one of the books. They made a movie out of it as well.
Although I didn't have that success until I was about 48 years old.
So you've written 11 novels and the success came late?
Quite. And that was my seventh novel. So, I think that makes me fortunate. I like that structure better. And so it wasn't a first novel that suddenly did fantastically well and then, that all my subsequent work is going to be compared to it.
You've said that there are no answers. All we can do is learn to live with the questions. Is that one of the things that you always keep in mind when you're writing a book?
I think it's just an instinctive position. At my worst, I'm didactic. At my best, I'm much more open-ended and inquisitive. And this book, for example, yes, raises all kinds of questions about what does it mean that we're getting so fat in the West? And I don't think that it delivers any decisive answers.
Well, I don't want to give any spoilers, but there is a terrible, unexpected twist at the end of the book, and one reviewer called it a dark, daring, heart-stopping shock. Did you know that you were going to do that from the start?
No, I didn't. Though I did know it by the middle of the book. I was unsatisfied with the ending I had in mind. Anybody who reads this book can see what that ending would have been. And
because it's moving in that direction.
Yes. And that ending, the original, would have indicated that the author didn't believe that it was possible to lose weight in the long term. And I didn't want to write a book that seemed to take that position.
Lionel Shriver's novels include The New Republic, which was a National Book Award finalist. So much for that. The New York Times bestseller, The Post-Birthday World, the Orange Prize winner, We Need to Talk About Kevin. And she's also written a fair amount of journalism. Her latest novel is Big Brother, and it is published by HarperCollins. I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.